SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, in association with SNI, Surgical Neurology International, is pleased to present another in the SNI Digital series on controversies in spine surgery, three 40-minute lectures with discussion. They're given on the topic of pearls and pitfalls of anterior and posterior cervical spine surgery by Nancy Epstein. Nancy is a professor of clinical neurosurgery at the School of Medicine at the State University of New York at Stony Brook and the editor-in-chief of Surgical Neurology International. She's been in the practice of spine surgery for 40 years. And has a bibliography that's one of the most extensive in the field. A series of lectures on pearls and pitfalls of anterior and posterior spine, cervical spine surgery are focused on how to choose the correct approaches to lesions in the cervical spine with attention to the K-line. Part one is on the anatomy, imaging, clinical presentations, of cervical spine neurologic disease and one-level ACDF, 40 minutes. Part two is on approach to two-level or more anterior cervical spine lesions, also 40 minutes. And part three is on approaches to posterior cervical spine lesions, also 40 minutes. This lecture on pearls and pitfalls of anterior and posterior cervical spine surgery is using the K-line in choosing approaches to anterior cervical spine lesions. It's a 40-minute lecture with discussion.
So we're going to look at or focus on how do you make a decision as to whether or not to do an anterior operation, a posterior operation, or a 360 on patients with cervical disease. So how do you decide which direction to do multi-level surgery in? And here, you need to look at what's called the K-line. It's the vertical line from the mid-C2 to 7. A positive K-line, which I'm showing you here, you go mid-C2, you put a dot in the spinal canal. You go mid-C7, you put another dot in the spinal canal. You put a line, or you know, a vertical line between the two. If your pathology is in front of that line, anterior to that line, okay, you have a choice. You could actually do, that's called a positive K-line, by the way, anterior surgery, posterior surgery, or 360 surgery. And what I'm going to discuss and argue later, if you have that option, doing a posterior cervical procedure does not incur many of those risks and adverse events that you see with anterior cervical surgery. So why wouldn't you choose that? Okay, on the other hand, okay, you may have the negative K-line. What are you seeing with that? The negative K-line. Here's the top, the bottom. If your disease extends behind that line or posterior to that line, like in this instance, this would be, looks like OPLL, it's likely, more likely than not, you need to do an anterior operation. And the reason, you know, I always say likely this, that, and the other, because there may be other circumstances where you may modify, you know, your technique and what you choose to do. Many surgeons, by the way, don't even know that this line exists.
I was just going to ask you, how many people use the K-line as a deciding factor? Is it common or is it not common?
It's very uncommon. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, you come to depositions where the person being deposed has no idea what this is, has never encountered this. And they just say, oh, I just gestalt it. And hey, I go for it. Or the other day I was speaking to a relatively new surgeon who said, well, I know how to do the anterior discectomy infusions. I don't know how to do the posterior cervical. In this case, it was the laminophoraminotomy. So I'm just going to do what I know how to do.
So you've used this for years, right?
Yes, yes. And it's been out for years. I mean, this is published. I'm not making this line up, okay? But again, here is your negative K-line, disease you see is posterior to that line seen over here and here. And here was the study that I'm quoting here, the negative K line. You're likely to choose an anterior surgery for discs, spurs, spondylosis, stenosis, and/or OPLL. And again,
That was a paper from 2012.
yes.
That's 12 years ago.
Oh, yeah. And there are many more that have discussed this since then. It warrants single versus multi-level anterior corpectomy infusion. So here's just a figurative diagram of a one-level anterior corpectomy infusion. And then you have your plate and you've placed your screws. Okay. And here's an example of a multi-level anterior corpectomy infusion, plate and screws. But I'm showing you here that if you have done more than a one-level anterior corpectomy, a two or more level, this graft and plate has to be stabilized by a posterior fusion. If you do not do an accompanying posterior fusion, that graft is going to extrude at least 20% of the time if it's a two-level corpectomy, and at least 50% of the time if it's a three-level corpectomy or more.
Good, you
And
mentioned that. That's really an important point.
yeah, and I'm going to repeat that actually. So here, I'm just going to show you again, your anterior corpectomy infusion. By the way, watch out for those instances. Instead of doing the one-level corpectomy, some people are going to say, well, I'm not so good at the one-level corpectomy, I'm better at the discectomy. Well, two-level anterior discectomy, and I'll show you a case at the end, can leave disease behind that vertebral body, especially OPLL. Okay. And if you're taking off a good portion of that end plate, you have to watch out for pistoning of the graft between those end plates. So you're going to hire with the two-level ACDF, you're going to have more subsidence, body fractures, and graft extrusion. So here's your two-level anterior discectomy infusion. Okay. And I'm showing you this again. You have your grafts that are placed here. But again, you've taken off a portion of the end plate here, portion of the end plate here. You can weaken that end plate by up to 50%, depending on how much of the end plate you've taken out. If you do that, what you can risk is that the grafts start pistoning into the cancellous bone of that intervening vertebral body, and it can result in the vertebral body fracture and graft extrusion.
So
So this is what
how do you avoid that?
do your one-level corpectomy. You have also two interfaces here to fuse. Here you're going to have four interfaces to fuse. And remember, I had just said before, with a two-level anterior discectomy infusion, your pseudarthrosis rate there is going to be about 24%, and it's much less with a one-level corpectomy.
Good, good. Okay, terrific.
And here's an example of where you have to really evaluate the images, understand your images, read your images, don't just believe whatever your radiologists are telling you. But here's a midline sagittal MR. Here's C2, here's C3. Well, certainly looks like a big, huge soft disc, by the way, that's coming down. And look, it's extending to the mid C3 body level, but it's also going down to the C4-5, to the C3-4 level, not further below. Okay. Your stenosis, your disease is anterior. By the way, look on the MR, your cord markedly compressed in a high signal that you're seeing in the cord. And so this would be a good patient for a one-level corpectomy where here's C2, anteriorly you take off the vertebral body of three, then you have no trouble accessing the entirety of this disc extrusion that's going at least to the mid aspect of the vertebral body. You're coming down directly on it, you can see it. It's ending at the C3-4 disc space. So you can do a C2 to C4 anterior corpectomy infusion, put whatever graft and plate you're going to put in. And then this might be, your X-ray post-op where you have your corpectomy, plate and graft are in place. And this is just showing you, this is your vertebral body graft. You see here, this is where that graft ends. And then you've got your ridges posteriorly here and here, preventing that graft from going further back.
Yeah, good.
Okay. And you have to measure and shorten your anterior and posterior dimension of your graft to take that into account, because again, you don't want that graft to be pistoned into the canal by forgetting to put in those posterior ridges. And then here's your plate, et cetera. Well, here's an example where if you just did the MR alone, you could be in big trouble because on the MRI scan, it was misread that this is C2, this is C3, this is C3-4 was misread as a soft disc herniation. And just to focus on that, misread as a soft disc. By the way, note on the MR how you can see, look at the high signal in the cord opposite this level of compression, right? Here's the cord coming down, here's the cord coming up. High cord signal, marked cord compression as well. Okay, you do the CT scan, and this is the same patient, and look at your calcification, ossification. This is actually OPLL, a version of OPLL called the other form that often looks like a disc or mimics a disc. And it's mid-body to mid-body. Well, to do this, you're going to have to go probably, C2 to C5 in order to adequately remove and resect all this calcification in front of the cord. Okay, so good use of your CT and your MR and how you can be led down the garden path if you just do that MR alone. Some people are going to say, oh, the CAT scan, it's too much radiation. That's usually not the reason. Some of them say, well, I really don't want to delay by getting a CAT scan because I want to send that patient in and get the surgery done really quickly before they go to somebody else or change their mind or something like that. CAT scan can give you so much information, as a CAT scan can just be smarter than you are. If you just obtain more of them, it can keep you out of trouble. You don't have to be brilliant to order it. Again, emphasizing the CAT scan does not show you definition of the cord itself, cannot show you the high cord signal, but shows you the bony changes. That otherwise, this is the negative image that you're going to see on an MR where bone appears hypointense. And here it is on the CAT scan, hyperdense.
Let me ask you a question. Go back to that picture. I'm in the operating room and I get a lateral C spine to see
Right.
if my graft is in accurately. Is that going to be a good determinant? Is a magnification going to be missed? Is it is that do I can I feel comfortable with that?
I mean, to get a lateral cervical X-ray to determine if you've taken out a sufficient amount of the OPLL.
Yeah, so in that I put a graft in and it didn't go in too far. Is that
Yeah.
going to be helpful, or is there some error in that and with the technique and everything else?
Well, I think if you've planned to do your corpectomy and do the resection that we've discussed, I think the lateral cervical X-ray will probably do. I mean, a lot of us are using, the intraoperative O-arm. You just bring that in, swing it around, boom, there's your CAT scan to tell you if you've adequately resected the pathology. So that's preferable if you have access to that.
Okay.
If, however, you're doing an anterior discectomy infusion here, you're going to be shaving more and more of the vertebral body. You're going to end up with less than half of the vertebral body above, half of the vertebral body below. Remember, if you're taking off that end plate, and you've taken off that end plate completely, you've got a 50% strength left in this body and that body, and you have a good chance that if you put a graft in there, that it may fracture out. Plus the fact that you have not adequately and accurately completely decompressed the degree of cord compression above and below that disc space level. Oh, by
Okay.
the way, though, a lateral cervical X-ray, if you have ossification of the anterior longitudinal ligament, can, on the other hand, be very, very effective
Yeah, I
if you
can see
just see the
that.
calcification directly anteriorly. But
I'm just wondering about relying on it 100%. Oh, it says I'm okay.
you can't. You
It
can't.
can't.
And
Okay.
it's a good reason to get a post-op CT scan if you have any question about it, or to actually presumptively get a CT to confirm that you've adequately resected disease. And we used to, with multi-level OPLL, all the time get post-operative CAT scans to see what we have. This is just to reemphasize that if you're doing multi-level anterior corpectomy infusions, you have to accompany it by a posterior fusion to stabilize your anterior graft. So this was a study. Vaccaro did a study in 98. I had a study also, Journal of Spinal Disorder in 2000, for a three-level anterior corpectomy infusion, a 50% risk of extrusion without an accompanying posterior fusion. And this is not something you want to do one day and then come back the next day. Ideally, you're doing one, you're flipping the patient over, and you're doing it immediately to avoid getting that graft extruding in the first post-op day, or keeping them intubated overnight, et cetera. So that's a C3 to 7 anterior corpectomy infusion, three levels. Here's a two-level anterior corpectomy infusion, C2, C3, 4, 5. This is down to 6. Obviously, that's a metal construct, but without that posterior effusion, 20% risk of extrusion. Alternatively, here you have your anterior strut graft, et cetera, and that posterior effusion is going to help stabilize your anterior graft. Again, same anesthetic, very good idea. If you have to do it, flipping it overnight, keep that patient intubated overnight. I can't emphasize how critically important that is, because if you then have to reintubate that patient the next day, that's a good opportunity for that anterior plate and graft system to extrude, or for you to injure the patient in some other way. Here's an example where you did a two-level corpectomy and put in a metal strut graft with a plate. Here's C2, C3, C4. 5 and 6 have come out, and here's C7. Now, this is an immediate post-op study, and here everything is there. That's a two-dimensional CT. Here, on the other hand, this is your two-dimensional CT scan when look at your C4 body. That graft has completely fractured out, and C7, forget it, that's morcellated and completely fractured out as well. Here's your plate and your screw. Everything is anterior to the vertebral body in this instance. So that's what can happen if you don't do that simultaneous posterior fusion in these cases. Now I just want to introduce, ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament. Too often in the States in particular, people say, well, that's a disease that they're seeing in Asia, but we really don't have it here. And I'm just emphasizing, you see this in the United States in about at least 25% of our patients. It's another reason to get that CAT scan in addition to the MR if you fail to read OPLL on the MRI scan, and the findings can sometimes be more subtle. So this is just figuratively what OPLL looks like. It's behind the vertebral bodies at single or multiple levels, and it compresses the cord, and it's defined as four types. I actually visited Hirabayashi in Japan, and we went over this. Continuous is when it goes behind multiple vertebral bodies. The next kind, it's called segmental, is you have ossification just behind the vertebral bodies. Here, continuous, it crosses the interspace. Here, it does not. But then you have the mixed form up here, where you have continuous in one area and you have the segmental in the other. So that's the third form of the mixed form. And what may be completely baffling, maybe the final one, which is the other form, which is it's at the disc space or appears to be at the disc space, but in actuality goes above and below the disc space, just like the example that I had just showed you. This can be the most risky because surgeons will typically go in based on an MR, assuming that they're going to encounter a disc, and before they know it, they're in the middle of the spinal cord and that patient's quadriplegic because they forgot to get a CAT scan and to acknowledge or to look for more extensive disease. So here you're looking at a patient with a negative K sign and multi-level OPLL, because that's what we're going to look at here. Unlikely requires, this patient's going to likely require an anterior operation, because if you put in the line C2 to 7, all this OPLL is going to be in front of you, and you've got to resect that. Okay, so here's in color, the same diagram. Basically, these were actually drawn by Joe Epstein, my dad, who was, a neurosurgeon. And another example, though, where you may have OPLL and the patient has kyphosis, and you can see the anterior angulation here. Okay, and there's clear reversal of the cervical lordosis, another reason to do an anterior procedure, because if your K-line is here and your K-line's down here, all of this bone is going to go behind that line, indicating you're going to have to go from the front. When you get a CAT scan or you add a CAT scan to the MRI scan that you're getting in patients, it may show you any one of these three signs of OPLL extending to and through the dura. And especially the double layer sign will give you 80% plus leak if you do anterior operations, which you may still have to do, but you can then be prepared to deal with it. So here, this is a typical single layer sign where, where this is. It's a little, it can be very regular, sometimes a little irregular, but the C sign often will accompany the single layer sign. And it means that there's sort of a chunk that goes off to the side. I had described this years ago. And what happens is the dura on the side can become imbricated or enfolded in OPLL. So you've got to watch it with this. But very much so, the double layer sign in these two images, you see how you have bone, the vertebral body, and then that hypodense area, and then that hyperdense ossification. That ossification is inside the dura. That hypodense area is the dura. So in these cases, there is going to be no interface, no dural margin that's going to allow you to avoid a CSF leak. It tells you if you have to go anteriorly, because look at the size of this compression. If you have to go anteriorly, be prepared to deal with that leak and be prepared ahead of time. Prepare your patient. Make sure your OR has the equipment that you need. Again, an example of a negative K line. Here's your K line going cephalad caudad. OPLL is behind that K line. And here's an actual two-dimensional CAT scan. Look at this. This is all OPLL. Continuous C2, C3, C4, and then a little discontinuity at the C4-5 level. But you see the way it becomes hypodense and hyperdense again. This chunk is intradurally, as is this chunk, as is this entire chunk here. So that's going to be, you know, your negative K sign with OPLL and multiple foci here, 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 and here of your double layer signs. So you're not only going to have an anterior leak, but it's going to cover many, many levels, and you've got to be prepared to deal with that. On an MRI scan, this may be what you're going to see, C2, C3, C4, but look at 5, 6, and 7. This is actually OPLL. How do I know that? Because the hypointense area not only crosses the disc space and goes up half the body, but look at the separation between the posterior aspect of this entire vertebral body. This is C5, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is C6, and coming all the way down to the, you know, 6, 7 level, sort of almost midway. In this instance, this is going to be OPLL, and you really need to get a CAT scan to get more definition, and also look at the MR showing you the high signal in the cord. So you're going to have to be prepared to do a very extensive resection in this case. Here is your single layer sign of OPLL. Everything behind here is ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament on your axial image. This is a case where you can see this is the double layer sign, calcification here, intradural here. This may be a single layer sign over here with a C sign because it's going off to the side. But in short, the CAT scan's your friend. It's going to show you this. It's going to tell you how you might have to prepare to deal with this intraoperatively because it's going to be extensive. And these are just some other cases of negative K lines. An MR scan, this is C2. Look at 3, 4, 5. High signal in the cord. Look at the MR scan showing this hypointense mass behind multiple levels. Okay, that is showing you, that is telling you. This is OPLL. These are not discs. These are misread as discs all the time, but wrong decision. On your axial studies, you may see a mass that's this big. Do yourself a favor, get that CAT scan and plan according to where the disease is. And both of these MRs are going to show you the hardcore signal for this OPLL with, you're going to have to do a corpectomy of C3 to get this. It's all the way like 3/4 of the way up the body and all the way down to like C5, 6. And you're going to have to do a strut from C2 after you've taken out 3, 4, and 5, strut to C6, and then do a posterior fusion to stabilize that. Okay. And here, another example of multi-level OPLL seen here. Again, figuratively, here's your OPLL, OPLL drawn here. Here's your anterior graft that you may be placing, anterior graft and strut here. Or you may be using a cage to put in your strut graft and your cage and your plate and your screws, et cetera. Again, when you do the multi-level corpectomy and fusion, you have then decompressed the spinal cord through that entire extent, anteriorly and posteriorly, and your cord can then migrate posteriorly away from where your anterior OPLL used to be. It's removed. The damage, the risk, the negligence of doing an ACDF is that you end up stretching or damaging the cord over residual OPLL left behind the individual vertebral bodies. So I showed you this before. You're doing the discectomy, discectomy, discectomy. But what about the OPLL here, just figuratively shown in here, that you're not accessing? You may have some surgeons say, oh, I can access that with a curette. Well, no, they can't. Or they access it with a curette, they damage the cord, and they get a massive CSF leak doing so. But here, leaving behind that OPLL, you're going to end up with an anterior discectomy fusion, literally stretching your cord over this residual disease. This is a very complicated case that involved multiple issues. This patient preoperatively had actually an MR similar to this because I couldn't use the exact images, okay? Preoperatively, the MR was misread, misinterpreted by the surgeon as discs, as multi-level disease, and he did a multi-level discectomy fusion. By the way, he did not follow the advice of his radiologist, who questioned whether there was OPLL and told him to get a CAT scan, and he didn't. He failed to diagnose OPLL, did the multi-level anterior discectomy fusion, stretched the cord over multi-level residual OPLL. He also incurred massive anterior cervical CSF leaks, and I'll show you how he did not correctly deal with that, and even sustained a vertebral artery injury because it was too far off to the side. And this patient was quadriplegic post-op. Well, what should he have done? He should have done a multi-level anterior corpectomy infusion with a strut and a plate, and then done a simultaneous posterior fusion. Okay, but that unfortunately was not what was done in this case. Instead, I'm just showing you he did a multi-level discectomy infusion, putting a bone graft at two levels, and stretching the cord over the residual OPLL, which I'm showing you figuratively here. And then here, I'm trying to illustrate to you with your ACDF grafts, you put the grafts in at these multiple levels, but look at the OPLL that's still going to be left over behind that. That's where you're stretching the cord. That's where you're damaging the cord. Okay. And in some instances, other surgeons, they're actually just getting down to the OPLL and leaving it behind completely. I remember visiting Leuven in Europe, and I was talking to them because the surgeon had done an artificial disc replacement. And he said, look at this post-op scan. Look at all the calcification post-op. And I looked at the study and I said, this is OPLL. You never took it out in the first place. So you have to be very careful when doing these procedures. Do the right operation for the right reason. Spinal fluid leaks with anterior cervical surgery with an ACDF, very, very low risk, 0.2 to 1.7%. But you get to OPLL, it's as high as 6 to 12%. So anticipating this leak should be part of your modus operandi. And again, if you get that pre-op CT scan and you see a single layer sign, as I'm showing you here, and the positive C sign and your double layer signs, then you know that there's a problem in these cases. And again, here's your CT. This is a post-op CT, kind of like what the CT showed in this patient. The CT showed a double layer sign post-operatively at multiple levels, and that's your intervening dura. And this is basically here where only some of this was removed and most of this was basically left behind. And again, right to and through the dura. When you have a patient where you suspect you're going to get an anterior cervical leak, it is very the best thing to do is to prepare and drape at the very beginning of surgery. You mark your anterior incision, but you then prep and drape out for a wound peritoneal shunt where you can put a shunt right in the neck with a dome, bring it down subcutaneously to the para-umbilical region. Well, the para-umbilical region is here, but maybe just over the liver, where you can actually put in a distal end of a shunt here if you have to do that intraoperatively. And you want to do that because if you don't do that and you just put in a lumbar drain, CSF, just because it's easiest for it to egress into your wound, may asphyxiate that patient, much less cause that wound to dehisce and fall apart. So in the early days, we use a unishunt. These days, you can use whichever shunt you want, but track the shunt catheter from the neck to the abdomen for that wound peritoneal shunt. Also, postoperatively, prepare to have available to you the placement of a lumbar drain. It's like belt and suspenders. You can control the amount that you're going to drain with the system that you're using. And by the way, when you put in the wound peritoneal shunt, you're going to have a horizontal vertical valve to control the amount that's draining if that patient happens to be upright. The other alternative, too, is here to just immediately go to a lumboperitoneal shunt, because what's going to happen is you're going to be draining CSF in this patient. It's still going to be draining, and you're going to want to take that drain to the outside out in about 7 days so you don't get an infection. That's just at the point where your leak may be in full force. And so a lumboperitoneal shunt from the get-go or in a delayed fashion may be what you then choose to do. Now, in this case, I actually was allowed to use the actual postoperative CAT scan. Postoperative CAT scan, easy to get, quick, but what's that going to show you? It's going to show you the location of the graft, the screws, plate, et cetera. It is not going to show you what's happening to the cord, okay? This is what the MRI scan showed. By the way, both of these studies were done in a delayed fashion. They waited a number of hours with this patient quadriplegic post-op. This is your post-operative actual MRI. And here is your, that is your Duracil. They put in Duracil anterior to the cord. It is contraindicated on the package insert to use Duracil anterior to the spinal cord because it can cause a mass, and in this case, cause massive cord compression. Seeing these findings, the radiologist said, wow, there's a lot of anterior cord compression. But instead, the surgeon did a laminectomy. A laminectomy from behind here was not going to really solve this patient's problem because it was such massive anterior cord compression, and this patient ended up remaining quadriplegic. Postoperatively, unfortunately, the surgeon, or fortunately, the surgeon left town for a while and left associates in town. For 3 weeks, they did no other studies. 3 weeks later, patient was transferred to another institution. They reoperated on that patient. It was too late. You know, nothing came back. So it's a combination of errors. It may be the surgeon themselves. It may be the associates. It may be the adjunct of personnel in the hospital. But everybody should be. The other thing we want to include here, I think, Jim, is just the references that people can look at.
Okay.
Neurological recovery after traumatic cervical spine injury. This is talking about when you reoperate on patients, the earlier the better, less than 24 hours. But if they have a significant deficit, you don't wait that period of time. It's like 0 to 24 hours, 6 or 12 hours. So here's in this study from Neurotrauma 2015, decompression infusion, 8 to 24 hours. At 6 months, you're going to have better ASIA grade, AIS grades. That's like ASIA grades, essentially. So suggest that patients with spinal cord injury undergo surgical studies within and decompression within 8 hours after injury, and they're going to have better outcomes. Here's another study from Burke et al. In neurosurgery. Surgery within less than 12 hours, you're going to get relative improvement in these patients. Another study from Lancet 2021, early surgery, you're going to see greater recovery versus the late operations. And they said, quote, there was a steep decline in changes in total motor score with increasing time duration the first 24 to 36 hours after the injury. And in Kui et al. 2021, early surgery less than 24 hours. Compared with late surgery, acute spinal cord injury, early surgery, greater recovery. Global Spine 2017, this is Wilson et al., and it included Failings, who was one of the promoters of Time is Spine. Early surgery supports improved neurological recovery among spinal cord injury patients undergoing early surgery. This is a systematic review. This was Failing study in Global Spine 2024. Early surgery, again, overall moderate strength evidence. Early surgery, less than 24 for better recovery. Very critical, except for those with longer. And here is Failing's article, Global Spine, Time is Spine. All spinal cord injuries, preclinical evidence suggests early limited secondary injury reduces damage to the neural tissues and improves function. ultra-early surgery, they couldn't make a comment on, but all of these factors are important in trying to get the best results.
Okay. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. Material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. At the end of this video, please fill out your evaluation of this program. And these are recorded sessions available free on snidigital.org. If you have questions, comments, or want to request CME credit, write to ausman@snidigital.org. There are many ways to learn. The foundation supporting these programs has, as one of its journals, a 2D internet journal with Nancy Epstein as the editor-in-chief. It is SNI, also known as Surgical Neurology International. Its web address is sni.global. The other journal is a 3D live new video journal of neurosurgery and neuroscience, interactive with discussion. It's SNI Digital Innovations in Learning, and the web address is snidigital.org. The information on both of these journals is free on the internet to everyone everywhere, 24/7, 365. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territories. It's been published for 14 years. It's the third most widely read 2D journal in neurosurgery. SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is now seen in 106 countries in 5 months. It's a new 3D video journal. The goal of the foundation is to help people throughout the world. Also, it has a medical news network dedicated to bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. These programs are sponsored by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation. They're copyrighted in 2024. All rights are reserved. Thank you for watching the program. We hope you've enjoyed it.